Good morning again. I have the great pleasure of introducing my colleague, Dr. Farnum Jahanian, who has exhorted me to be brief, so I've cut down my 45-minute introduction to 15 minutes, you'll be happy to know. Farnum serves as the National Science Foundation Assistant Director for SCIES, Computer and Information Science and Engineering. He also, I'm very happy to say, serves as the co-chair of the NITRD program, which, as you probably didn't say, is a subcommittee of the National Science and Technology Committee. Dr. Jahanian holds the Edward S. Davidson Collegiate Professorship in Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at the University of Michigan, where he also served as Department Chair of Computer Science and Engineering from 2007 to 2011. Earlier in his career, he held research and management positions at IBM's T.J. Watson Research Center. Over the last two decades at the University of Michigan, Dr. Jahanian led several large-scale research projects that studied the growth and scalability of the Internet infrastructure, which ultimately transformed how cyber threats are addressed by Internet service providers. His research on Internet infrastructure security formed the basis for a successful Internet security services company, Arbor Networks, which he co-founded in 2001. Dr. Jahanian is the author of over 100 published research papers, has served on dozens of national advisory boards and panels. He holds his graduate degrees in computer science from the University of Texas at Austin. He's a fellow of ACM, IEEE, and AAAS. Without further ado, Dr. Jahanian.
Good morning. It's good to be with you. George, thank you for that kind introduction. Aren't you glad I asked him to give a short introduction? It's good to be with you. I want to thank Sriram and also Tim Finn for the invitation to be with you, and also thank the co-chairs, Michael and Leo, and everyone who contributed to organization of this ninth summit. As I was sitting there and you were talking about the origins and the roots of this summit, I'm reminded, I'm not a member of this community, but I'm reminded of a point that, you know, anytime you embark on an interdisciplinary exploration, anytime you're trying to bring individuals with diverse backgrounds to bring to bear on a problem, it really requires sustained investment in time and resources over year after year. Interdisciplinary collaboration really is about building communities. And I think the success that you're enjoying here, the ninth symposium or summit, is a reflection of the sustained investment of resources and your time in building this group of individuals who are contributing to this intellectual exploration. I'm also thrilled to see that you have representatives from not only government and academia, but there's tremendous interest also from the private sector. I appreciate the opportunity to spend, we're right on time, and I'm going to finish hopefully just a little bit early. Certainly I don't want to be the first one to make you be late today. And I know you have a long couple of days ahead of you. I was asked to share with you some thoughts about big data, and in particular, opportunities related to big data. As we think about it, not just in the context of investment from the federal government and National Science Foundation, but broadly speaking in terms of our interaction with the academic institution and also the private sector. I think to most of you, as I talk about the promise of big data, I don't have to convince you that, okay, I'm on slide number 3 for the folks who are listening virtually or participating virtually. As I'm sure all of you agree, advances in information technologies are transforming the fabric of our society, and data represents a new currency for science, for engineering, for education, for commerce. When we talk about big data, often we're talking about the era of data and information. The truth is that we're actually drowning in data tsunami. As it was already mentioned, big data is not only characterized by enormous volume or velocity of its generation, but equally important, particularly for the discussion that's taking place here, it's also about heterogeneity. It's also about diversity and complexity of the data sets. All of this, of course, is enabled by experimental methods, observational studies, scientific instruments. I'm going to come back to a bunch of this in a moment, and sensors everywhere. Of course, there are technologies, technological advances that have enabled this, you know, cheap storage, huge data centers, easier access and programmability, advances in hardware architecture and data management tools, and of course, advances in data mining and machine learning. And I'll say a few words about that as well. What's possible, however, what's exciting is new insights into science, spotting, for example, new business trends, preventing diseases, managing our precious resources, potentially transforming education. And that I will give a couple of examples of that as well. There was an influential McKinsey report a couple of years ago that referred to big data as the next frontier for innovation, competition, and productivity. But before we go down that path, why is big data so important? I mean, if you think about it, especially for those of you from the private sector can attest to this. You know, we've talked about decision support 20, 30 years ago, online analytical processing, OLAP, business intelligence, business analytics, and now big data. But let's first of all ask the question of why big data is important, and then I'm going to come back why now and what's different in a moment. There are really three reasons that I highlight as far as the importance of big data. One has to do with the profound implications for the economy, insights and more accurate predictions from large and complex data sets potentially drive creation of new products and services, boost productivity of businesses, create new business models. We've seen examples of those over the last few years especially. And, in fact, just an anecdotal example of that, just the data technology and services market alone. It's not a big market. Just the data technology and services is expected to grow from about $3 billion in 2010 to over $16 billion just in a couple of years, in 2015 and 2016, according to a recent IDC report. So one has to do with the transformative implications for commerce and the economy. The second reason it's important is because of its importance and criticality to accelerating the pace of discovery on almost every science and engineering discipline. And we see this when you talk to biologists, when you talk to material scientists, when you talk to chemists. And finally, the potential of big data is also there for addressing many of our societal challenges from, I'm in slide number seven, from data-driven discovery and innovation that are addressing many of our societal challenges, from environment and sustainability to energy production to manufacturing to emergency response and disaster recovery, not to mention cybersecurity, health and well-being, and, of course, education and workforce. And, again, I'll talk about a couple of examples of those shortly. But where is all of this data coming from? So for the next 10 minutes or so, I want to talk about various sources of data just to show you the enormous richness and also at the same time complexity, not just the size, complexity and diversity of the kind of data set that we're dealing with. I am on slide 8. Moving now to slide number 9. So where is all of this data is coming from? They're coming from sensors everywhere, from coming from ubiquitous computing, mobile devices, social media, scientific instrument, and so on and so on. But let me give you a few examples of that just to motivate the discussion and show you the complexity. First of all, this is one of my favorite slides, which I borrowed from Intel Corporation, and it's only a couple of years old. We all recognize the explosive growth that we've seen in volume and traffic diversity over the Internet. To further exemplify this, look at some of the data. This is about 2 years old, in 2012. In 2012, for example, in just 1 minute on the Internet, there were 200 million email messages, 83,000 sales on Amazon, 278,000 tweets. Actually, I was just with a few folks from Twitter, and what I understand is now in 2014, that has grown to 500 million tweets per minute. 220 million photos are shared on Flickr, and the list goes on and on. But a couple of data points here might be of special interest to you. At the lower half of the box, bottom half at the left side, if you can see this in the back especially, in 2012, the number of devices on the network roughly equal the population of Earth. By 2015, which is just a year down the road, it's expected we're going to have twice as many devices on the net as the population of Earth. That's a staggering increase if you see it. And there are two things that are motivating this. One is this use is actually has been there partially because of the tremendous growth that we've seen in mobile devices. And also the second is the emergence of new apps, as I said, partially fueled by social networks. So let me elaborate on that for a moment. Consider mobile devices and cellular networks. Mobile devices are the only digital device today that are accessible to the majority of the planet. We have about 6.8 billion people that are connected through cellular networks. There are about 7 billion people on Earth. But the traditional internet users are about 1.5 billion. And the number of mobile connected devices will soon, actually, as I mentioned, exceed the number of people on Earth. Let's dig a little deeper. Chris Serdak, in a book which has been recently published called Data Crush, elaborates on this issue in particular. The first thing has to do with the fact that mobile devices have eclipsed traditional, essentially, computers as a point of entry for the internet. Always on, always connected. That's leading to massive amount of data that's being generated. Consider for a moment that in 2012 alone, 34% of homes no longer had a landline. That's a huge number if you think about it. And by 2015, wireless web is expected to exceed wired use in the United States, and that's actually already happening in Asia Pacific and in China, as you probably know. The second relevant point has to do with data services and applications that we're seeing that are catalyzed by these mobile devices. In particular, smartphones are able to access data in a wide variety of forms, from texting to web browsing to apps for everything and, of course, streaming services. Consider that there are 1 million distinct active apps just in Apple's App Store, and they're for commerce, they're for healthcare, social networking, education, and so on. In 2013, just last year, 17% of web browsing and 55% of social media interactions are done using essentially mobile devices. This shows a huge growth, and that growth is just going to accelerate over time. And, of course, when we look into the future, we're talking about wearable computing and the Internet of Things, all the buzzwords that we've been hearing about. It's really about smart everything and having everything being connected and be online. We're talking about wearable devices such as smart glasses that will contribute to, again, an explosion of new data sets. Also, bulk of mobile traffic will come from things that are from things rather than from people, from smart cars, smart appliances, smart meters, smart medical devices, and so on. So this is one area that we've seen a tremendous growth in the kind of data that's now available. Let's go one step further and talk about the ramifications of social media. So, of course, this is another source of data growth that we've seen, especially over the last 5 years. I am on slide number 12. So here's a question. How is it that companies such as Facebook and Twitter that provide all these free services could be worth billions of dollars? I'm not objecting to their valuation. I'm just asking why is it. It really has to do with monetization of user data. It has to do with monetization of your data, essentially. In 2012, over 1 billion people approximately spent 10 billion minutes per day on Facebook. That's 400 minutes per month on a site, essentially. Also, in 2013, Facebook is collecting about 500 terabytes of user data every day, 500 terabytes. And by 2014, as I mentioned, the number of tweets per minute is about 500 million, contributed by about 250 million active, essentially, users on Twitter. And all of that essentially is leading to a new business model, if you will, which is all about selling data to third parties, creating targeted advertising, detailed profiling of customer behaviors, of course, opinions, preferences, predictive analytics, and so on. And I'll say a little bit more about some of the issues in this area. But there's old way of marketing and a new way of marketing. This level of intimacy is potentially intrusive by highly variable. For the folks in the industry would tell you that the old CRM systems, when you think about it, versus new customer engagement, customers' expectations, of course, are changing, expecting much deeper engagement with companies and personalized services. So the whole area of marketing is also just changing as a result of this. This is leading to new business models, new product, new services online, and most of this has really to do with monetization of data that's available. And, of course, you could see that explosion. Let me talk about another sector in our economy. We've also seen a huge amount of growth in data that, of course, is transforming every sector of the economy. But one particular sector I want to highlight is the healthcare sector. There are many sources of data in healthcare, from electronic health record to during hospitalization to sort of inpatient and outpatient data that's being collected via mobile and sensors that are implanted on our bodies or in our clothing or our environment. And, of course, there are tons of data that's available as part of clinical studies, and there's a growing body of scientific data that's used, essentially new knowledge in biomedical research and so on. These are often heterogeneous. They are distributed with diverse, significant diversity at multiple temporal scales and multiple levels, ranging from molecular to organ systems to behavioral and even, of course, social data. So what does that mean? One example of that is that we're seeing a growing ecosystem of wireless devices, not just smartphones, but also consider, for example, Fitbit, which I have one of these. I'm not advertising for a particular company, but it's an interesting device. It's very simple, but it really has changed my behavior. And part of it has to do with the kind of data that it collects during the day. And I realized, George, that around 2 p.m. to 4 p.m., I don't move around much. So I started taking random walks in the building, which is making a lot of people nervous, as it turns out, when they see me between 2 and 4 p.m. But let's not go there. All of these different kind of data sets for healthcare that I talked about have a potential transformative impact on healthcare in improving diagnosis and treatment, preventing onset of diseases, enhancing quality of healthcare through assistive technologies and so on, and empowering us actually to participate in our own health and well-being, as what I was just alluding to a moment ago. I said a lot about healthcare and other types of social data and data that's available through our smartphones and so on, but I didn't say anything about science. And we are actually in the National Science Foundation. Think about telescopes. Think about particle accelerators, think about genome sequencers. Science is gathering data at an ever-increasing rate across all scales and complexities of natural phenomena. I have to tell you, people of my generation would tell you that 20 years ago when I'm trained as a computer scientist, when I talk to my colleagues in biology or other areas of science, in chemistry and so on, the focus was often on computation. And now when you talk to them, they talk about data. Not that I want to caution you. I don't want to make an artificial distinction between computation and data. As it turns out, I've always believed that these are two sides of the same coin anyway. You can't have one without the other. In fact, if you think about it, some of the largest data sets that we're seeing today come as a result of essentially these simulation tools that we have. But it's interesting to listen to our colleagues in biology, in material science, in chemistry, in social sciences, people who do research in education, how they talk about data as transforming the way they do research. As an example, consider the Sloan Digital Sky Survey Telescope, which in 2012 collected more data in its first few weeks than have been collected in the entire history of astronomy, just in the first few weeks. Within a decade, it collected over 140 terabytes of data. Sounds pretty impressive. Now, the LSST telescope, which is being considered for construction a couple of different federal agencies, including the National Science Foundation, and it's being built in Chile, is due in a few years, 2-3 years, if it goes through construction. will have the ability to collect double that quantity every week. In fact, it will collect about 40 terabytes of data every night. Just imagine that. And that's just one example. We see examples from all areas of science and in terms of increasing complexity of the kind of data sets. In fact, what we're seeing is, my apologies to the folks on the phone, we're on slide 16. I don't want to call it a paradigm shift. I want to say we're seeing a change from hypothesis-driven to data-driven. These two are complementary. It's not that we're walking away from hypothesis-driven scientific discovery, but it's now being complemented by data-driven discovery. And data is motivating a profound transformation in the culture and conduct of scientific research. In fact, data-driven discovery is revolutionizing scientific exploration, as I alluded to. This is often referred to as the fourth paradigm of scientific discovery to the contrast to the earlier three approaches. And it's real, and we see it in every discipline. But one thing that I hear from my colleagues also in biology and material science and other sciences is they are in some ways, although they're collecting all of this data and so on, are overwhelmed by the amount of data that we're able to collect. And more, I'll have a few things to say about that in a moment. The final comment I want to make about sources of data is something that I said already, which has to do with sensors everywhere, from environmental sensing to sensing that's used during emergency response to sensors in healthcare applications and, of course, people-centric sensing. So we see this everywhere. And, of course, the future is going to be everything connected and always on. As I mentioned, our ability to generate data today far exceeds our ability to digest it, and that's a challenge for almost every discipline. Whether you're in the private sector or public sector, it doesn't really matter. Our ability to generate the data far exceeds our ability to digest it. But what's possible? What's possible is to go from data to knowledge to discovery by enabling extraction of knowledge from large heterogeneous data sets, providing novel approaches to driving discovery and decision-making, and, of course, yielding increasingly more accurate predictions in weather modeling, for example, and forecasting, and potentially saving lives. And, of course, providing deeper understanding of causal relationship based on advanced analysis. And that seems to be one of the toughest problems. I promised that I would say a few words. What's different and why now? Because we've been talking about it. It's not like a couple of years ago, a handful of people woke up and said, you know, data is really important. We should do something about it. We've been looking at data and playing with data for decades. Certainly in digital form has occupied us for decades. But what's different about big data and why now? Turns out there's a confluence of social, technical, and policy interests that place us on a new terrain, if you will. The horizon is clear enough where we are today, where we can say that we can have a glimpse into the future and see there's some really differences that we see and it's potentially transformative. One has to do, of course, with technology. Think about advances that we've seen in technology. Moore's Law, pervasive sensors, data mining, advances in machine learning, advances in natural language understanding, advances that we've seen in information retrieval, in computer vision, in video and analytics, data visualization, social networks, all of that, this confluence of advances we're seeing in technology is contributing to this. Also, we've seen, of course, plummeting cost of computation, communication, and storage. We're seeing consumer technologies, broadband connection, and social media, as I mentioned, contributing to this. But probably the most important thing is that data is no longer regarded as a static entity. It's a raw material or a corporate asset, if you will, used to create economic value and foundation for new business models. And, of course, with the interest in all around us in increased transparency of democratic governance, we see public access to high-value data becoming a huge priority, as it is for the current administration. And probably equally important here is that, 10 years ago even 5 years ago, data management tools and many of the machine learning and data analytics tools that we're beginning to take for granted were only available to very, very large organizations with tremendous resources. Today, what we're seeing is these types of tools and technologies are available to small companies, to researchers. There has been a democratization of data and tools that's taking place. Now, I don't want to say that we've arrived. In fact, data sharing, as all of you know, is a huge problem, not only for the science community, but also for the public sector. A couple of other things about characteristics of big data that we see. One, of course, has to do with distinction between structured data and unstructured data and blending of this, such as customer sales records versus unstructured data, which is like email. Also, metadata has become increasingly important. I'm reminded of a quote by Fred Smith, who is CEO of Federal Express in 1978, who said, "Information about the packet is just as important as the package itself." That really reflects, he was in some ways a visionary in 1978 looking at this and saying, you know, metadata is really, really important. And I think he's been proved right. And of course, another important distinction here is that even 10 years ago, when we talked about data, particularly in the context of private sector or enterprises, it was about the data that's inside an organization. That's fundamentally different from today, the environment we have today. It's not only about the data that's inside an organization, but it's also that data is generated by always-on customers, ubiquitous sensors, social media, and so on. Most of this data is actually outside the organization. And, of course, we're talking about incomplete, fragmented, and long-tailed data, as I'm sure all of you are familiar with. And, of course, multiple format and heterogeneity of data sets contributing to significant potential challenges. We actually see three shifts in the way we analyze information. I want to refer you to a terrific book called Big Data, a Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. And the authors highlight these three shifts. And they very convincingly say that information is no longer small, exact or causal in nature. Our capabilities change when data is huge, can be processed quickly, and we have to be able to tolerate inexactness, if you will. Ability to collect, manage, and analyze far more data than can be artificially limited by sampling. It's also messy, which is loss of accuracy and exactness at the micro level, but potential insights that can be gained at the macro level. So we lose the exactness, we lose the precision at the micro level, but we gain understanding at the macro level. And finally, discovering patterns and correlations that are meaningful, that help us make decisions, but the challenge here is that it doesn't necessarily imply causality. And that is a fundamental problem in data analysis today. For the folks on the phone, I'm on slide 23, moving to slide 24. So let me say a few words about Federal Big Data Research and Development Initiative. President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, on its review of NIDERD investment, this was the 2010 review that took place. As George mentioned, NIDERD has coordination responsibility for the number of federal agencies, now grown to 20. PCAST talked about investment in this area as a national imperative, called on the federal government to increase R&D investments for collecting, storing, preserving, managing, analyzing, and sharing the increasing quantity of data. And also PCAST observed that the potential to gain new insights, to move from data to knowledge to action, has tremendous potential to transform all areas of national priority. So a couple of years ago, you may recall, there was an administration initiative that was launched with the leadership of OSTP called the Federal Big Data R&D Initiative. It's a cross-agency initiative. It was a work of a senior steering group under the NIDERD Charter led by National Science Foundation and NIH. and with significant input from various federal agencies, at the time 18 agencies, and of course significant input from the research community. And the senior screen group was charged with developing a framework and a plan, and the work has continued. But one outcome of it was the Federal Big Data Research and Development Initiative. And this was an announcement that happened with a bunch of agencies from NSF to NIH, NIST, DOD, DARPA, and so on. And a cornerstone of that was a big data solicitation that involved NSF and NIH, but involved almost every agencies and various initiatives involving those agencies. A lot has happened since then. And if I were to spend the rest of my presentation to talk about what various agencies are doing enough, in fact, the senior steering group on big data is working essentially on the next iteration of that framework. But DARPA has launched a number of new programs, three new programs related to big data. It, of course, is a focus area for NIST, and there's a big data public working group that is led by NIST. Department of Energy, as part of its extreme scale science, focuses on multidisciplinary R&D for data reduction, scalability, and data fusion. NIH has made massive investments in this area, and in fact, a new program called BD2K is something that was an initiative that was launched just about a year ago, facilitating broad and use of biomedical big data, developing and disseminating analysis methods of, and software, enhancing training, enabling centers of excellence. I think Phil Bourne will be here this afternoon and is going to talk to you about some of those. There are activities in USAID, NASA, NOAA, and of course, I'm sure most of you are familiar with data.gov, that's working on streamlining and automating agency submission of data sets on this platform. Again, there is a lot going on, and I certainly did not do justice by during the last 2 minutes highlighting them. As far as the National Science Foundation is concerned, I thought I'd share you're going to hear from DARPA also, I think either today or tomorrow, right? Tomorrow. From Dan Kaufman, so you'll get some insight into DARPA and NIH's investments in this area. But let me spend a couple of minutes on National Science Foundation's investment in this area. When we look at this, we think of big data investments being in four broad areas, and this is not just the SAIS Directorate, the Computer Information Science Engineering Directorate. We're talking about across the foundation, involving every essentially science and engineering discipline, and education, of course. One is in the area of foundational research, to develop new techniques and technologies to drive knowledge from data. We're talking about new data management techniques, new data integration solutions, scalability is front and center, data mining, machine learning, all of these research areas that the community has been working on for a number of years. So that is going to continue. We're also making significant investment in new cyber infrastructure to manage, curate, and serve data to the research community. As I mentioned, the needs of the science community are just enormous. And when you talk to them, we're just scratching the surface. We don't really know how to manage these large data sets. Curation is a huge problem, as you know. And also serving these data sets to the research community is an important issue. New approaches to education and workforce development. I'm going to come back to the education challenges in a moment. But there are two aspects to this. One is, data is transforming research in education, and at the same time, we have an enormous need in this country for training data scientists. More on that before I wrap up this morning. And finally, parallel essentially to the work that you're doing, whenever we talk about interdisciplinary collaboration, it's about building communities. So we're making significant investments involving the SAIS Directorate, my directorate, and other directorates in building interdisciplinary communities. A notable example of that is EarthCube, which involves the geosciences community. We're doing a similar thing with social sciences. We'll be doing something with the bio community. Building, bringing researchers with diverse backgrounds to do collaboration on data. One particularly for the researchers in this room, one particular solicitation, there are two of them that I want to highlight. One of them is the critical techniques and technologies for advancing big data science and engineering. This is a solicitation that's on the street now. It focuses in two areas, foundational, which encourages fundamental novel techniques, theories, and methodologies and technologies of broad applicability. And then there's also a focus on innovative applications, encouraging novel techniques, theories, and methodologies and techniques of interest to at least one application. So you see there's interest in foundational research plus what we do with that data, which I think this should be of direct interest, particularly to the researchers in this room. We're also making significant investment in another program called Data Infrastructure Building Blocks, or DIBBS, and the focus of that is on cyber infrastructure to serve the science community. I encourage you to take a look at that if you're interested in this. I'm on slide 29, moving now to slide 30. So when we talk about big data R&D, when you step back and look at this, it's about foundational research, it's about domain-specific application research, and it's also about cyber infrastructure pilots. And you see the various federal agencies have sort of the same model in mind in terms of their investments. Of course, I'm now on slide 31. Of course, when we talk about our investment in these four broad areas, there are policy issues that cut across. Let me highlight a couple of them. Researchers, of course, want data. Public policy requires access to data. Public policy also requires protection of privacy, intellectual property, and sensitive information. This, of course, poses a potential challenge for publishers and societies that support the science community. As you probably know, February 22nd of last year, the federal agencies were directed by the White House to develop plans to support increased public access of results from federally funded research. One important aspect of this is that I'm sure most of you are familiar with this, is that it's not about public access just to peer-reviewed publications. Of course, for that, the directive says should be stored for long-term preservation and public accessible to search, retrieve, analyze in a way that maximizes the impact on opportunity of the federal research investment. So we understand the peer-reviewed part of it. But it's also a directive that asks for a plan for digitally formatted scientific data resulting from unclassified research. Should be stored and publicly accessible to search, retrieve, and analyze. Various agencies have submitted their plans. NSF has done that, and you'll hear more about that hopefully soon. But the point particularly for this community is we're not talking about just a peer-reviewed publication. It's also about digitally formatted scientific data, which brings essentially your expertise to bear. And we do know that the implementation plan for any kind of a public access will vary by discipline. This is kind of the disclaimer, if you will. New business model for universities, libraries, publishers, and scholarly professional societies could emerge from this, but we recognize that this actually varies from discipline to discipline even. As I mentioned, the interest isn't just in the federal government or academic institutions. There's tremendous interest in the private sector in transformative impact of big data. One of the things that we've been involved in as a follow-on to the big data R&D initiative, NSF led the White House Data to Knowledge to Action event last November, during which 30 new public-private partnerships involving 90 partners were announced. This was quite exciting. All of this is available online. You could see all sorts of essentially partnerships that were formed without really necessarily the federal government being involved. This involved the private sector, the public sector, also academic institutions. For example, NASA and Amazon agreeing to make a significant fraction of NASA data available on Amazon Web Services, an example of what we saw. As far as the federal government is concerned, there are also a couple of other White House initiatives that I think, administration initiatives that have significant data ramifications. One is, of course, the Materials Genome Initiative, whose aim is to help businesses discover and develop and deploy new materials twice as fast. That's the goal. Data simulation, as you know, is an important driver in discovering new materials for circuits, batteries, and other innovative technologies. And I'm sure most of you have heard of the BRAIN Initiative, which is, again, an administration initiative which was launched about a year ago. This involved NSF, NIH, and DARPA. I am confident that my colleagues in NIH and DARPA will also talk about this. So I'll be brief. Of course, the goal here is to address, and I'm on slide 36, to address critical challenges of research integration across multiple scales, ranging from molecular to behavioral level, builds on NSF's, from NSF's perspective, it builds on our unique ability to catalyze multidisciplinary research and ongoing NSF investment. Just for your information, you should know that every directorate and every discipline at NSF is involved in this initiative. Significant data ramification for us. Let me, in the remaining minutes that I have, talk about some success stories in terms of what we have seen in terms of the impact of big data. I'm on slide 38, now moving to slide 39. One has to do in the area of enabling patients, curing diseases, and serving lives. A couple of examples. The one on the left, is work by Zishan Say at the University of Michigan and John Gutak at MIT. And what they have done is they applied data mining and machine learning techniques to identify new biomarkers from EKGs that can help determine heart abnormalities and defects, leading to significant improvement in identifying and treating at-risk patients. What's fascinating is these markers were not identified by researchers in the past, and it was through the application of essentially data mining, machine learning techniques that they were able to identify these computational biomarkers, if you will. And it's leading to new, essentially, treatments in identifying and treating at-risk patients. The second example, the one on the right, has to do with predicting survival time of breast cancer patients and new, essentially, approaches to treating this disease. As you know, we lose 40,000 women to cancer, to breast cancer, each year. This work, led by Daphne Kohler at Stanford, applies image analysis techniques to breast cancer biopsy images and has been able to identify a small subset of cellular features out of 6,000 possible that are predictive of survival time among breast cancer patients. What's fascinating is that this feature set that is the best predictor were not from the cancer tissues itself, but rather from adjacent issues, something that previously had gone undetected by pathologists and clinicians. There are numerous other examples. When I mentioned the public-private partnership event in November, there were several announcements at that event. One actually had to do with a partnership among several private sector companies to improve access to clinical trials for patients while also making data from clinical trials more accessible. Here's another example of participation from the private sector. Another set of examples, totally different category, has to do with transformative implication for commerce, unlocking information for companies and organizations to run at an optimal efficiency, potentially enabling sophisticated new ways and new business models. Some of you are probably familiar with this because this got a lot of attention. And it's a story that hit the headlines a few years ago, and it has to do with UPS. By analyzing a continuous stream of sensors from its thousands of essentially delivery trucks, UPS eliminated 5.3 million miles from its routes, reduced engine idle time by almost 10 million minutes, saved, they claim, 650,000 gallons of fuel, and reduced its carbon emission by more than 6,500 metric tons per year. This has saved the delivery company millions of dollars, but also has had an impact in terms of our carbon footprint. A great example of data collections from sensors and so on, and analysis of that. A closer example, limited to a city, is that New York City data analytics is enabling new businesses to open their doors to customers on average of 45 days sooner, and this is based on their analysis. New York's mayor, the previous mayor, essentially uses city data to help businesses get off ground in New York. Mayor's office, they actually have an office of data analytics that focuses on projects that improve daily operations to prepare and respond to disasters and also support economic growth. So they have an office that actually focuses on data analysis, if you can imagine. What about the environment and our future? I mentioned actually NASA, an example where NASA and Amazon teamed up to provide a significant amount of NASA's data in science data and models available to the public. Here's another example that was funded by the National Science Foundation. This shows an example where big data has an important implication for guiding energy use across the grid and even in our homes. The young researcher that's you see his picture, I'm on slide 45, Shoatek Patel at the University of Washington, has designed these new sensors called ElectriSense that provides insights to usage in home. Here's what's really cool about it. These sensors use essentially machine learning techniques that allow online monitoring of water and electricity by recognizing the unique signature given off by every faucet, toilet, appliance, and electronic devices in your home. So they've actually developed a sensor that you plug into the wall, I'm oversimplifying it, and by monitoring essentially your usage, it has developed a signature for your toaster, your toilet, every faucet in the house, appliances, and electronic devices. And it can essentially provide information to you, allowing you to track your electricity usage and water consumption. He's built two different kinds of sensors, one for electricity, the other one for water consumption, and give customers access to their usage is a powerful, essentially, tool for motivating changes, similar to my Fitbit, I think. This has significant ramifications. For example, smart meters in major cities, it's estimated, can reduce carbon emission by 27 metric tons. That's the carbon equivalent of 1.2 billion trees. What about accelerating the pace of discovery in science and engineering? There are numerous examples of the role of big data. An example, and I was going to show you a video of this, but because we had folks participating remotely, I won't be able to show you the video. I'm on slide 46. But it's an example of Amy McGovern at the University of Oklahoma with Kelvin Drogemeyer that they're essentially using data and computational approaches to predict tornadoes with some amazing results. But the belief is that, in fact, very soon we'll be able to predict a tornado 1 or 2 hours ahead of time, potentially leading to life-saving measures. But a couple of other science examples. The one that I just mentioned is on slide 47, right-hand side. Again, a truly terrific research that determined tornado formation and has led to more reliable tornado forecasting. A couple of other examples, one from social media, and this is on slide number 48, the one on the left. There are opportunities where social media provides rapid insight into the extent of a damage following a catastrophic event. Excuse me. For example, tweets analyzed and modeled following the 2011 earthquake in Japan and 2011 earthquake in New Zealand estimated the epicenter intensity of each earthquake. My colleagues in geoscience say that it's not only about understanding where an event has happened, it's also about evacuation. It's about dealing essentially with the role of social media during a time of natural disasters. In the interest of time, let me jump to next segment of my presentation. I want to talk about some of the barriers, challenges, and opportunities when it comes to big data. There are in a bunch of different categories, and I'm going to go through them pretty quick, and the slides are, of course, available for your viewing. The first one that I want to start with, as a computer scientist, I just want to go on record saying that technology alone will not solve all of our society's challenges. So when we talk about big data, when we talk about the transformative implications of data analytics and machine learning and data sharing and so on, we need to recognize that it's not just through technology advances that these transformative impacts are going to happen. We must consider economic, social, and cultural barriers to adoption of these solutions. So Rosal's social scientist, behavioral scientist, an economist in all of this is extremely important. The second issue I want to raise has to do with big data and security. And there are two aspects of it. One has to do with how big data analytics can be used to identify cybersecurity issues. And there are lots of great examples of use of essentially data that's being collected to deal with cybersecurity challenges. I'm going to skip that. The second has to do with the issue of securing confidentiality and integrity of the data that's collected, accumulated, and analyzed by organizations. My single sentence for you about challenges of cybersecurity, which I think all of you recognize, is that if you want to see where our cybersecurity challenges are going to be 10 years down the road, just follow technology and internet adoption patterns. In fact, the challenges now we see in mobile computing, wireless, cloud computing, in cybersecurity reflect the adoption patterns of these devices and technologies. The challenges that we see in cybersecurity dealing with social media reflect the adoption patterns that we've seen in social media technologies. But let me say a few words about big data and security. Well, big data is a big security target. Apple has 400 million customer credit cards on file, and I bet you more than half of you in this room, Apple has your credit cards. I'm sure they do. How many of you have made a recent purchase with Apple? Just curious. Well, I wasn't too far off. Good. All right. Facebook has, as I mentioned, 1 billion registered users who share more than 1 billion pieces of content every day. But the challenge here is, as I mentioned, remember I said big data isn't about the data that's just inside the perimeter of an enterprise. It's also about all the data that's outside it that you have potentially access to. So it's no longer about protecting internal data. It's also, one has to consider the impact of platforms and ecosystem. So even if you trusted Apple 100% or Facebook 100% in terms of protecting your data, the truth is that there are more than 1 million apps in App Store, majority of them not developed by Apple. The question is, how do you secure partner platforms and third-party apps? And, of course, cloud and virtualization makes this problem even much, much more difficult. I know security is beyond the scope of your discussions over the next couple of days, but let me just scare you a little bit. Especially when it comes with cloud computing and proliferation of mobile devices, an organization's information is no longer stored and accessed within its walls or perimeters. Information is created and, of course, stored on the web, potentially. Here's the problem. With increased virtualization and distributed nature of the data that we're dealing with, we're talking about confidential information and intellectual property that are increasingly flowing from back-end systems that organizations don't control through networks that they don't control to endpoints and end users that it doesn't control. And, by the way, that was slide 56. Now let me say a couple of words about big data and privacy since I have your attention. Okay, we all know this. Amazon monitors our shopping preferences. Google tracks our browsing habits. Facebook captures our social interactions and more. And Twitter, of course, tracks what's on our mind in real time. Wireless operators, AT&T, Verizon, and so on, track our connections and who's nearby. Of course, the challenge here is that, as I said about monetizing the data, is that we need to worry about privacy issues. And in particular, a number of scholars have pointed out that informed consent, opting out, or anonymization are not as effective to ensure privacy with big data. How can companies provide notice for a purpose that has yet to exist? How can one give informed consent if new secondary uses of information haven't even been imagined? What if anonymized data can be mined with other public data sets to identify private information? These are all serious privacy concerns and considerations. Moving to slide 60, as you know, President Obama ordered a comprehensive 90-day review of the way the big data will affect the way we live. Privacy issues, ramification, I believe that report is due within the next couple of weeks. The next challenge that I want to talk about is predictive analytics. Now, remember I said that data mining and pattern recognitions could lead to lots of great things, predicting flu outbreaks, predicting election outcomes, suggesting customer preferences for books, predicting customer behavior. Who could be against preventing unhealthy or dangerous behavior, preventing quality of customer experience, improving business. We are all for that, no doubt. But one thing I want to caution you about, and it goes back to one of the issues that I mentioned at the very beginning, correlation doesn't imply causation. This is a fundamental issue that often researchers are ignoring today. The fact that remember that we are potentially through big data losing micro-level precision and gaining macro-level correlation. But the challenge here is that when you gain macro-level correlation, it doesn't imply causation. As suggested by Nassim Taleb in his book, Fooled by Randomness, it's possible that you're seeing some sort of a correlation, but it's actually a false causality, and it's not real connections. So the challenge for us is we need to make sure that we don't cross the line from improvement to profiling, crossing the line from prevention to penalizing, because we're essentially drawing conclusions from correlation rather than causation. I promised I would say a few words about education and workforce development, and I'm to my last couple of slides. McKinsey, in the report that they did a couple of years back in 2011, very succinctly said, by 2018, the United States alone faces a shortage of 140,000 or 190,000 people with data analytical skills, and more than that, of course, for managers and analysts and so on. The challenges for us in terms of education and workforce development with people who have data analysis capabilities is tremendous, including some of the essentially skills that you talk about in this venture. Since you're all about ontologies, you should know that the data scientist has been declared as the sexiest job of the 21st century by Harvard Business Review. How can you go wrong with this? We see an explosion of essentially data science programs across the country involving computer science, statistics, and other disciplines. Just an example of that, New York Times even hired a chief data scientist, and the number of private sector economists has surged 57% over the last few years for firms that are looking to help them digest data. NSF launched a traineeship program this last year called NRT, NSF Research Traineeship. This is a replacement for our IGERT program. It's broad-based, covers all areas, but one priority area that we mentioned this year should please you. It's on data-enabled science and engineering. So this is a replacement for my fellow colleagues from academia that replaces our IGERT program, which is traineeship, multidisciplinary traineeship. But one area, so the new traineeship, it's broad-based. It could be any area of exploration, biology, chemistry, interdisciplinary research, and so on. But one area where my fellow assistant directors all agreed as a priority area was data-enabled science and engineering, and all aspects of data science and engineering. That should please you that we got the message. Final comments. Paradox of innovation is that no one knows how an invention will impact the world until it's widely used, leading to unintended consequences. I hope over the last 55 minutes or so, I convinced you that we can imagine a day that by integrating biomedical research, clinical scientific data, we can predict the onset of diseases and identify unwanted drug interactions. We're not there, but we're getting there. By coupling roadway sensors, traffic cameras, individual GPS devices, I'm on slide 69, by the way, we can reduce traffic congestion, generate significant savings in time and fuel costs. That's happening today. We can accurately predict natural disasters, do a much better job of it today than we used to, tornado and data. And data is going to have a transformative impact on not only prediction, but also dealing with natural disasters and man-made disasters. When you talk to our colleagues in education, they'll tell you that their research has been totally transformed. The impact of MOOCs, impact of inverted classrooms, impact of access to data, and this whole new, essentially, area of exploration called science of learning is re-energized through access to data, and it's going to have a transformative impact on formal and informal education. Now, I'm not jumping on a bandwagon saying, oh, just have MOOCs and it's going to transform education. Far from it. It's about research and learning that's going to be informed through access to data. And of course, public safety and security could be potentially enhanced through data mining and text mining and video analysis and so on. With that, I want to thank you for your time and just wrap up by saying the opportunities for future, going back to the beginning, are that Big data has transformative implications for commerce and economy, critical to accelerating the pace of discovery and innovation in every discipline, and it enhances the quality of life for societal well-being. With that, thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Farnam, for that inspiring and visionary talk, which I think sets the stage for the rest of the workshop. We have about maybe 5 to 10 minutes for questions. And is it okay?
Absolutely. Happy to take them. I thought I was out of time.
No, you're okay. We'll cut into the break. I think this is important. Okay?
Well,
coffee can wait.
And I'm happy to join you during the break.
And yes, Steve Ray.
I want to put a little controversy on the table. Though,
please.
I think that was very inspiring. But I also think it actually illustrates one of the challenges this community, the ontology community, faces, which is the blurring of the promise of big data, which I see as physical primarily, machine learning oriented, and how people don't sort of, that gets swept into the lack of really good examples of reasoning, of ontological. And I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that can be done right away with machine learning and
Absolutely.
Statistical analysis. But I think that's exactly one of the challenges this group is trying to face, which is how do we bridge that gap where it's the same as, like, you know, XML was going to solve all the semantics. Everyone jumped on the XML bandwagon. I worry that people will jump on the statistical.
Well, I think,
Google did,
of course. I think people have already jumped on the statistical bandwagon, if you will. There's no question about it. But, in fact, we have been very careful while, from NSF's point of view at least, while highlighting the potential transformative opportunities. And you're absolutely right. There's some huge, huge number of opportunities, low-hanging fruits, by applying. It's not just statistical. There are various techniques that are based on data mining and machine learning, many of them are statistical, that have come to bear. And they're really advancing scientific discovery. They're advancing essentially some aspects of commerce. And these transformations are real. They're having an impact. And while we recognize that at National Science Foundation, that's important. And by the way, we use that as an example of when you talk to people who did research in machine learning and especially statistical machine learning, including a number of folks at your institution, this has come as a result of 30, 40 years of sustained investment by the federal government in basic research, where 20 or 30 years ago, people did not know all of this was going to pan out. In fact, we pursued many dead ends before we were at a point where some of these techniques are so readily available, almost to a point that you think you can go to Best Buy and buy a package and run it. And I'm exaggerating the impact of that. So while on one hand, I would say, this shows that sustained investment by federal government really does come to fruition, and it may take decades of investment before it comes to fruition by public and private sector, at the same time, there are enormous research challenges that have to be addressed, including the ones that you mentioned. In fact, if you talk to the folks in the database community, they will tell you that they've been dealing with data warehousing for a long time. And big data is imposing some new challenges. They can bring some of the techniques that they have developed to bear, but that just scratches the surface. In fact, I was listening in your presentation earlier where you talked about scale issues and heterogeneity of diverse data sets, how it complicates the discussions that you have with ontology. One thing that I didn't say much about is a lot of advances you see, even in data mining and machine learning, requires domain-specific knowledge. How do you capture that? And how do you capture that such that not only is applicable to a very narrow problem set, but you can potentially expand it beyond that? We don't know how to do that, and that obviously brings to bear some of the discussions you're going to have it. You also mentioned, and you alluded to this as well, is that tools and software are incredibly important. And while we have a set of tools for rudimentary data sharing, let me put it this way. We also have a set of tools with machine learning and data mining. Tools for everything else we want to do, they don't exist. So I am violently agreeing with you, actually, that there's tons of research to be done, tons of work that has to be done to really come to bring this vision, if you will, fruition, if you will. But thank you for that question and comment.
Hi, Tim Finan from UMBC. Early on in your talk, you mentioned that the motivation for many companies providing internet services is to gather user data that they can then monetize. And there are concerns about privacy, but another concern that sort of I feel sometimes is that if organizations know a lot about us in the aggregate, they'll be in a better position to control us. And that control for a commercial business might be they're in a better position to separate a person like me from his money. And I sort of feel this is sort of an asymmetric situation, and it makes me a little nervous. I wonder if you could comment on that.
I hope that in my presentation I at least hinted that I agree fully with your concerns. When I talk about monetizing our private information, of course, this is not applicable to all internet companies. This is not there are a lot of technology companies that are selling you products and services. They don't rely on collecting information about you. But there are today many companies that have, you know, billion-dollar valuation, multi-billion-dollar valuation, that their business model is based on providing free services to consumers. And consumers are embracing them. We want them. In fact, people are our generation are a little bit more concerned about privacy issue. What really worries me, I have three relatively young children. They're teenagers and college-age kids. When you talk to them, the issue of privacy is just not at all there. They look at it as, oh, yeah, I'll make my data available and I'm getting these services for free. So I don't have a silver bullet for it, obviously. But in the slide when I talked about a number of scholars and researchers are not only concerned about this, they believe that many of our existing approaches, such as anonymization techniques or opting in and out, don't apply because of the kind of data that's being collected and how this data can be correlated with other publicly available information. I completely agree with you, and I think we're going to come to a realization as a society that there is a trade-off and there has to be some policies and guidelines and boundaries that we have to observe. But I don't think we're even close to that point yet. And I also want to make it clear that I'm not against technology companies that are making money. Far from it. That's what the private sector and free enterprise system is about. I think we're going to have to figure out a way to balance usability and utility of all of these technologies with privacy of individuals and privacy of our communities.
Amanda, last question.
Amanda Vives from Critical Lab. I have a comment and a question. The comment has to do with the point that Steve Ray brought up. As big data becomes more powerful, as the ability to generate information from big data becomes more powerful, it also becomes more tempting and easier to generate misinformation from big data, just as you can from any data. And I see two of the big contributions that ontologies and semantic technologies can make as being both the fusion capabilities to curate and provide metadata on data so that you can, if you're trying to get meaningful information, you can by combining things, and also providing the ability to query combinations, you know, big data conglomerations, just say, to see whether they in fact are meaningful in various ways. My question then following on is, is NSF and are the other agencies, Sierra Awareness, paying attention to that and trying to push that research along as well as the underlying big data stuff?
I'll speak for NSF, and I believe other agencies are interested in this, but perhaps not from a basic research or foundational research point of view. Obviously, mission agencies who are looking at data and particularly on analysis of data are keenly interested in what the issue that you raised. I invite you to ask my colleagues from DARPA and NIH to see how they're going to approach this problem. This problem is at a direct interest. It absolutely is interest to NSF. In fact, the solicitation that I referred to, the big data solicitation, as we call it, focused on foundational research, this is an issue that has come up. I know it has, and I know it's been discussed among our colleagues. And, by the way, I completely agree with the comment that you made. That was right on the mark.
Question there?
Yeah, it uses time. If not, I can take it.
We have another 2 minutes, actually.
Okay. Relevant to the ontology community here, is there any talk of big metadata? Because you have giant, I mean, I work in enterprises,
yep.
You know, it's a huge problem.
Yep. A couple of things I want to point you to as we're running out of time. I don't know if you're familiar with this organization called Research Data Alliance, RDA, that's come together. NIST and NSF are strongly behind it. Also, it's become an international entity. There's a website for it. It has a lot of the library science community engaged in it. There are a lot of domain science folks are involved in it. It's something that's been ongoing for a couple of years. It's really growing rapidly. And they just had a meeting in Dublin last year. We hosted it in Washington, D.C. I've heard them talk about some of the issues that you raised, but I can't say that the ontology community is deeply ingrained into that. If you send me an email, I will connect you with some of the leadership of that. Fran Berman at RPI is the lead from the United States, has a grant from the National Science Foundation to lead that effort. I know they've talked about metadata. That's obviously, how can you talk about data without talking about metadata? But specifically whether the issues that you raise are being addressed by them or not, it's worth consideration. I can tell you that I expect, and this is my fourth year at NSF. I'm a rotator, so I'm do not see it as a long-term projection from NSF. But just my conversations with the community and my conversations, especially with the science and engineering research community, I think our investment in all of the issues surrounding the data is going to have to grow, because it is so critical to accelerating pace of discovery in almost every discipline. So my expectation is from investment in foundational research, in infrastructure, in community building, in data sharing, in managing and curating and serving data to the research community is going to have to grow over time to address the needs. With that, thank you again for your time. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.